From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what's it like to be a spokesperson for the tobacco industry and get paid to say that cigarettes are not harmful to your health? Christopher Buckley comes up with a devastating portrait of such a person in his new satirical novel, Thank You for Smoking. We'll talk about his novel and about growing up the son of famed conservative William F. Buckley. Also today, what's happening with airfares? Why is it that the person sitting next to you on a plane is likely to have paid a lot more or a lot less for a ticket than you did? We'll talk with Jim Glab, author of a new book about the changing airline industry called Rapid Descent. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new show premiering on Fox, Models, Inc. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Japanese parliament has elected socialist Tomichi Murayama as the country's new prime minister. He's Japan's third premier this year. The BBC's Philip Short reports from Tokyo.
Mr. Murayama's victory is the result of an unlikely alliance between the socialists and their longtime adversaries, the Liberal Democratic Party. He defeated his nearest rival, Toshiki Kaifu, a former LDP prime minister who was supported by centrist and reformist MPs, by 261 votes to 214. Mr. Kaifu had announced his candidacy only an hour or so before Parliament met, declaring in an emotional television broadcast he couldn't stomach the prospect of a marriage of convenience between the LDP and the socialists and was resigning from the party. Mr. Murayama becomes the first socialist prime minister here since 1947, but the new government's likely to be highly unstable because the LDP and the socialists disagree on almost all basic policies.
Philip Short reporting. PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat will travel to Gaza and Jericho this weekend. It's his first trip to the territory since the start of Palestinian self-rule. The trip has been approved by the Israeli government. Arafat's visit has been long expected and delayed. He has put off his trip for various reasons, including demands that donors first turn over $42 million in financial aid to the Palestinians. The Senate Finance Committee is holding public debate today over health care reform. The bill they're debating is not expected to require employers to cover their workers with insurance. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
As the House Ways and Means Committee nears completion of a measure that's similar to President Clinton's proposal, the Senate Finance Committee begins work on a bill that is not likely to meet his goal of universal coverage. Finance Committee Chairman Daniel Patrick Moynihan intends to first propose a bill that centers on the so-called employer mandate.
Let's find out whether we can't win.
Democrats on the panel have said publicly the employer mandate is destined to fail. Moynihan's fallback measure to achieve near universal coverage is similar to a proposal advanced by moderates on his panel. Under the plan, if voluntary measures don't achieve 96% coverage around the year 2000, a commission would recommend steps to meet the target. Meanwhile, Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole is polling Republicans on whether or not to push ahead with his own, less comprehensive plan. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The House Ways and Means Committee has rejected a tax increase on cigarettes of $1.25. This was supposed to help finance health care reform. Some supporters of the tax have reluctantly agreed to drop it in order to pass a comprehensive health care reform bill through the committee. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 4.5 points to 3,665. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up nearly 2 points at 703. This is NPR. The Commerce Department says a surprising surge in consumer spending forced the economy to grow 3.4% in the first quarter of this year. The agency says the gross domestic product report is better than had been anticipated. The government says the rise is linked to an additional $5.5 billion in consumer spending and business investment. The economy has slowed down considerably since the end of last year, but many analysts expect second quarter growth to remain steady. A central New York Indian nation may soon take a land claim to federal court. They're asking to be compensated for land taken more than 200 years ago. Eric Anderson of member station WAER in Syracuse has more.
The Onondaga Nation is working with the Indian Law Resource Center to sue New York State, Onondaga County, and possibly major landholders in the claim area. Syracuse-based attorney Joseph Heath says The nation chiefs are laying claim to about a fifth of New York State in their land action, a 50-mile-wide strip of land from Canada to Pennsylvania. He says nation leaders are hoping to get land and money as compensation, but they say private homeowners in the area, including the cities of Syracuse, Watertown, and Binghamton, shouldn't be concerned because they're not interested in evicting them. Talk of the legal action resurfaced in the wake of a recent Supreme Court ruling that effectively ends the nation's thriving tax-free cigarette trade. For National Public Radio, I'm Eric Anderson in Syracuse, New York.
Fire crews are beginning to gain the upper hand on fires in Southern California. 11 fires have charred some 27,000 acres of forest and brush from Central California to San Diego. Firefighters have contained a blaze that raged in the Angeles and San Bernardino National Forests north of L.A. That fire started on Saturday, apparently from a campfire. It destroyed 10 homes. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The tobacco industry has been taking a lot of heat from Congress and the FDA in the past few months. Now tobacco public relations experts are getting a kick in the pants from satirist Christopher Buckley. His new novel is called Thank You for Smoking. Buckley is only afraid that his satire might be outpaced by the absurdity of current events. His novel was already completed in April when 7 tobacco company executives gave sworn testimony at a congressional hearing denying that nicotine is addictive and that cigarettes have been proven to cause disease and death. Buckley is a former speechwriter for George Bush and is the author of the bestseller The White House Mess, a satire of White House memoirs. He's the son of famed conservative writer William F. Buckley. I'll let Christopher Buckley describe the premise of his new novel.
The basic premise of the book is a group of Washington spokesmen for dangerous industries. The hero of the book is a guy named Nick Naylor, who, as you might guess from his name, is the chief spokesman for the tobacco industry. His two best friends are a woman named Polly, who's the chief spokeswoman for the liquor industry, which in this case calls itself the Moderation Council, and a fellow named Bobby Jay, who is the chief spokesman for the gun industry, which in this instance calls itself SAFETY, which stands for the Society for the Advancement of Firearms and Effective Training of Youth, formerly the National Right to Bear Arms Committee. And collectively, they call themselves the Mod Squad, which stands for, not for the TV show, but for Merchants of Death. So it's about sort of yuppie, likable yuppie mass murderers, if you will.
Let's see how your character, Nick, your spokesperson for the cigarette industry, handles himself on the Larry King show. And your character has basically told Larry King that 96% of heavy smokers never get seriously ill. You want to pick it up from there?
Sure. "Where does that figure come from?" said Larry. "From the National Institutes of Health, right here in Bethesda, Maryland." Nick thought to himself, "Let NIH deny it tomorrow. Tomorrow people would be on to the next thing. Bosnia, tax increases, Sharon Stone's new movie, Patty Davis's latest novel about what a bitch her mother was." As long as he was at it, he threw in, "And from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia." "That is news," Larry shrugged. Larry was basically too polite to accuse his guests of being shameless liars. It was probably why Ross Perot liked him so much. With any luck, no one from NIH or CDC would be watching. "Of course," Nick said, "neither Secretary Furioso nor the Surgeon General, both of whom continue to refuse to debate with me on the issues, want you to know that, or their budgets will go down. Sad, but true." "Interesting," said Larry. "There are a lot of things," Nick sighed, "that the government doesn't want people to know about tobacco, such as," Nick thought to himself, what? "The indisputable scientific fact that it retards the onset of Parkinson's disease." Larry said, "So you're saying we should all wait till we're 65 and then start smoking like crazy?" "Well, Larry, we don't advocate that anyone should take up smoking. We're just here to provide the scientific facts. Like the report that just came out showing that tobacco smoke is replenishing the ozone that has been lost due to chlorofluorocarbons." "Really?" Larry said. "Well, maybe I should take it up again. Do my part for the ozone hole. I better check with my doctor first." Doctors tend to have their own agendas, Nick said. I'd also like to call to your attention the report last week that smokers who are clerical workers tend to get less carpal tunnel syndrome, you know, the wrist thing, because they take more breaks. There's something else the, quote, medical science establishment, unquote, doesn't want you to know about.
Well, thanks for reading that. That's Christopher Buckley reading from his new book, Thank You for Smoking. You've said the inspiration for this book came from watching the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour and watching somebody from the Tobacco Institute defending tobacco. What interested you so much in watching somebody defending smoking? People who are paid to defend it.
Their motivation. I didn't know anyone I went to college with whose ambition was to become the chief spokesman for the tobacco industry, or for that matter, the liquor industry or the gun industry. I wondered how, you know, 30-something, 40-something, you know, attractive yuppies ended up in this, doing this for a living. So I, having decided to write the book, I called them up, and I was mildly disingenuous about what my motives were. I said that I told them I was researching a book on neo-Puritanism, which Thank You for Smoking also is, and that I wanted to hang out with them and see what it was like to have to, you know, be in the front lines of the of all these anti-movements. And their motivation in the end turned out to be a little more prosaic than inspirational. At the end of the second meeting with this cigarette lady, I was dying to ask her, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? Of course, being a sensitive 90s male, I don't talk like that, Terry. So instead I asked her, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? And I remember very clearly she exhaled her lung full of smoke and shrugged, a very sort of sexy Lauren Bacall shrug, and said, I'm just paying the mortgage. And thus was born Nick's yuppie Nuremberg defense. I was only paying the mortgage. It was the motivation that interested me.
You know, I could say that it's easy for you to be cynical about the defense I was only paying the mortgage, since you've got a lot of dough yourself and you don't have to worry about it.
No, I'm a mortgage payer, Terry.
But it's probably a real big one.
I'm trying to pay it off. Don't like the idea of working for the First Bank of Boston for the rest of my life. That's why I write these books, Terry.
Your defense.
Yes, that's my defense. We're all one way or the other paying the mortgage.
Was it entertaining for you to try to come up with speeches for Nick to defend the tobacco industry with?
Absolutely. It was actually, though I find writing very hard, this was kind of fun to do. You know, there you are. You're the front man for an industry that kills, 435,000 human beings a year. That's just American human beings. And what do you say, you know, when you go on the Oprah show and you find yourself, you know, on with the, you know, the head of the Anti-Smoking Office of Health and Human Services and the head of Mothers Against Teenage Smoking, and then, uh-oh, what's this? A bald teenager, bald down, including no eyebrows. Turns out he has cancer from smoking. You know, what do you do? At that professional, at the technical level, it's a hell of a challenge.
Well, I love what you gave your character to do. I mean, Nick is very funny and can think on his feet. So in the middle of the Oprah show, and you just described all the other guests, he asks for a cigarette. And you want to explain why?
Yeah, Oprah has just given her introduction where she's talked about the 435,000 deaths per year. She's talked about RJR's Old Joe Camel promotion, which has hooked millions of American kids. You know, more kids can recognize Old Joe now than do Mickey Mouse. She's introduced all the other guests, all of whom are just, you know, fire-breathing anti-smokers. And then the last one is this poor 19-year-old teenager who's, you know, clearly dying of cancer and has had radiation treatments. And then she introduces Nick, and, you know, all the audience is glowering at him. And so what does Nick do? He pulls out a cigarette and says, do you mind if I smoke? And there's this gasp in the audience. And she says, you want to smoke? And he says, well, you know, I understand it's traditional to offer the condemned man one last cigarette. And that kind of breaks the ice. And the audience actually, one person in the audience starts to laugh. And then other people in the audience starts to laugh, to the great annoyance of the anti-smokers on the panel.
You've watched all the TV shows with all the smoking industry people defending cigarettes. What's the most incredible or interesting defense that you've heard them give?
Well, the obvious defense is that it's a free country, and 45 million Americans want to smoke. It's a legal product. They ought to be allowed to smoke as long as they don't, you know, blow it into your lungs. Believe it or not, there is some good news about not smoking but nicotine, which the anti-smoking movement doesn't really like to bring up. But in fact, there is strong medical evidence to suggest, as I read in that section of the book, that nicotine retards the onset of Parkinson's. Smokers have a 50% less rate of Alzheimer's disease. They have a 50% less incidence of endometrial cancer. Believe it or not, I mean, I guess God made nicotine for a reason. And so, you know, they could sort of hit it on that angle, but that they can't, you see, because they're a little hamstrung, because you can't make health claims for these things. It would be a little bit ridiculous if they went up before the Waxman Committee and said, well, but look at the evidence about smoking and Parkinson's disease. You know, there'd be loud guffaws from the back of the room. So I guess I guess they're stuck with, it's a legal product. 45 million Americans want to smoke under the Constitution of the United States, you know, under the tenets of Adam Smith. Someone's going to supply them with that tobacco. Why not us?
Satirist Christopher Buckley is my guest. His new novel is called Thank You for Smoking. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Christopher Buckley's my guest, and his new novel is called Thank You for Smoking. Did you used to smoke?
Yeah, I was a juvenile delinquent, and like most people I knew, and I started smoking when I was 13, and I smoked on and off. I started to give up, I started to give up in my late 20s, and then I finally gave up on September 14th, 1988. At 11:22 a.m., after keeping watch with at the bedside of a friend who was dying of lung cancer, his doctors told me he had 7 tumors in his lungs the size of golf balls. And without going into details, I can report that it is a pretty gruesome spectacle watching a human being die like that. And a toggle switch just sort of went off, and I've never again really had the urge, even after the second martini, which was when it used to strike.
How much had you smoked before that?
Oh, I smoked Camel Unfilters, so I never really. If I smoked 10 a day, that was a heavy day. The worst consumption was probably when I was in college, and it's 11 o'clock at night. And the 20-page paper on light imagery in Canto 12 of Spencer's The Faerie Queen is due at 8 a.m. in the morning, or you will not graduate, and that paper had to get done. And, by 8 o'clock in the morning, there was a yellow stain on the ceiling above where I had been sitting, and, you know, I'd gone through 2 packs of Camels, and, you know, that awful feeling that your lungs had been strip-mined Well, I don't have that anymore.
May I point out that not a lot of juvenile delinquents wrote papers on Spencer's Fairy Queen?
Well, but, that was a little later on.
When was the transformation?
From juvenile delinquent? Well, I guess technically, once I reached legal smoking age, which in Connecticut was 16. I'm not sure what it is these days. I think it may be 18.
Can we talk a little bit more about your youth?
Sure.
When you were very young, did you share your father's political views, his conservative political views?
Well, not when I was very young. As you know, the saying goes that a fellow who isn't a socialist when he's 20 has no heart, and a fellow who is a socialist at 40 has no head. I was reasonably rebellious, but I didn't have much of a chance to be rebellious. I was shipped off to a Benedictine boarding school run by monks when I was 13. So I spent the glory years of the 60s, you know, while the Summer of Love, Haight-Ashbury, Woodstock, you name it, while that was going on, I was in study hall with monks. So my rebellion took the form of shipping out in the Merchant Marine when I was 17, when I got out of boarding school.
Christopher Buckley is my guest. Your first novel, Steaming to Bambula, was based on your experiences on a freighter. And I guess it must have been after you got out of school, before college, that you signed onto a freighter as a deckhand, and that became the basis of your first novel. Why did you want to go onto a freighter?
Well, I grew up around boats, and I always thought that shipping out would be the most romantic thing you could do. I'd read Conrad and Melville, and my boarding school, this Benedictine boarding school, was on Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island, and it had, though it was a very good school, it had, you know, a boarding school is kind of like a prison if you're 13, 14, 15. And I would see all these freighters go by, and I would go down to the beach and sort of look at them and kind of wish I was, wish I could be aboard shipping out to exotic ports. And a couple of years later, I got my chance, and I signed on as a deck boy on a round-the-world Norwegian tramp freighter. And saw a bit of the world and came back with a tattoo, even.
What did the tattoo say?
Well, I had two tattoos, actually. One was on my upper arm, and it's a full-fledged tattoo with an eagle and sailing ships and flags and all that. And then I had another tattoo on my right hand, which, this being a family radio show, I probably can't say what it said, but it was a... If I held my hand in the saluting position, the officers receiving the salute would be more likely to be offended than pleased.
You had that tattoo removed.
I had that tattoo eventually removed when I had it for about 8 or 9 years. And one time I was working for Esquire and I was interviewing the King of Spain. And we were sitting sort of close together. And I found his eyes straying to the outer edge of my right hand. And I thought, well, here we're on the verge of a serious diplomatic problem here. So when I went back home, I went to a dermatologist, and this was in the days before laser abrasion, and he took out a shiny scalpel and cut it out, closed it up with 13 stitches.
Well, that must have hurt pretty good.
Yes, it did. Well, you know, what goes around comes around. I'm a big believer in karma, and I guess I just, you know, paid for my stupidity 9 years later.
So now when you salute, you have a scar.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't do as much saluting these days.
Let me just say here that I've just been informed that Steaming to Bambula is really a memoir, not a novel. So I stand corrected. I was reading this great anecdote about you in a Washington Post article about you that said, I think this was in the early 70s, you were coming home from Yale for the weekend or something, and you had dropped acid and came home to find that there was a 60 Minutes crew at home doing a profile of your father, and you ended up getting interviewed
I picked the wrong moment to duck into the house to pick up a sweater. Yes, it was. It was an interesting day.
I'd like to know what all of that looked like to you in your altered state.
Well, what Mike Wallace's face looked like under two hits of California sunshine. Well, it looked a little bit like Picasso's middle period.
And what was it like to be interviewed?
Well, it was extremely uncomfortable, Terry.
What kinds of questions
were
you asked?
What happened was, we dropped acid, and it was getting cold, so we happened to be walking by the apartment. I said to my friend, I'm just going to duck in and get a sweater. So we went in, and I literally tripped over a coaxial cable in the foyer, and I thought, what's this? And I looked up, and there was Mike Wallace saying, oh, great, we'll put you on next. And so I ran upstairs and found my mom, and I said, I really do not want to go on. She said, no, you have to do it for your father. I said, no, really, trust me, I really don't want to go on. She said, no, you must go on. So, you know, you're 17, your mother tells you to do something, you still have to do something. So on I went.
And what did you say? Did you ever see it back?
Yeah, but you know, it was an excruciating 45-minute interview. But obviously, I mean, the show was not about me. I mean, they were looking for the 5-second bite to the question. You know, do people ever razz you about your dad? And I guess I managed to get through it without drooling. But it was with great relief that I got back to the street afterwards.
What was your father's reaction when he found out, perhaps years later, that you were high?
Well, we haven't really discussed it. I think he's a really wonderfully tolerant and understanding guy. I mean, he would not have enjoyed it at the time if I had said, "Hey, Dad, I do acid," but he was always a remarkably tolerant, I dare say, liberal dad.
Among the many things that you've written and jobs you've held as a writer, you were a speechwriter for then-Vice President Bush in the early 1980s. What kinds of occasions did you have to write speeches for?
Well, I was his only... I was Vice President Bush's chief speechwriter, or only speechwriter, from 81 to 83. And I wrote everything he said, other than the ones he winged. So there would be speeches, there were toasts, there were a lot of eulogies. Remember, his motto was, "You die, I fly." arrival statements, departure statements, just about everything. It was really a great experience. And to anyone who's thinking of going into the speech writing business, I would only offer the observation that writing for a vice president is in some ways a lot more fun than writing for a president, because you see them, you actually see them, you travel with them. The Reagan speechwriters that I knew hardly ever saw him. You know, one of them had seen him twice that year, and that was to pass him in the hallway. You know, there are so many layers between you and your principal.
Are there certain things that you felt were cliches, but you felt you had to use them anyways, that you need an element of that in speeches?
Well, I managed to get through my year and a half without ever typing the words, "This great nation of ours." This was probably my proudest accomplishment.
Christopher Buckley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Christopher Buckley's new novel is called Thank You for Smoking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, No Frills Airlines and how they're changing air travel. We talk with Jim Glab. His new book, Rapid Descent, looks at what happened to the airline industry after deregulation. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new Fox program, Models, Inc., by the makers of Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Forces from North Yemen continue their attack on the southern capital, Aden today. Southern leaders say their oil refinery is burning because it's been hit by northern airstrikes. The BBC's Simon Ingram has more.
The UN Security Council's uncertainty over how to achieve a ceasefire in Yemen has given northern forces a further opportunity to force Aden's surrender. Northern artillery and warplanes again attacked strategic installations, including the oil refinery in the western suburb of Little Aden, which is now reported to be ablaze. The main power station has come under shell fire, as have several civilian areas, causing a number of casualties. More than 300 people are said to have been killed and hundreds of others wounded over the past week as the siege of Aden intensified. The southern leadership continues to insist that the city will not fall, but it's questionable how much more punishment the civilian population is ready to take.
Simon Ingram reporting. A newsletter finds that overall U.S. mail deliveries are getting better, but the Postal Service didn't do as well this spring as it did last year. The independent newsletter Business Mailers Review says in the spring quarter, just 82% of letters that should have been delivered the next day made it on time. That's about 3% better than in the winter. Mail officials had blamed previous poor service on bad weather. Second and third day mail deliveries this spring also were worse than they were a year ago. Postmaster General Marvin Runyon has announced a management restructuring to deal with customer complaints and a budget deficit. A political ethics group wants the public to know that many former members of the House have pocketed millions of dollars in campaign funds they had left over when they left office. NPR's Barbara Campbell reports.
The Center for Public Integrity says some former members are legally entitled to do whatever they want with their excess campaign money, depending on when they took office. The center reports that some give it back to the donors, others just keep it. One former member built a museum to himself. The center's director, Charles Lewis, says their contributors should pressure former members to use the money as the donors intended.
I would go to every one of these people and say, what did you do with this money and what are you going to do? And show us your statements and open up your files and get some sort of commitment from them about what they're going to do.
In recent years, Congress became embarrassed about the personal use of the money, and it now requires members elected since 1979 to donate unused war chests to political or charitable causes when they leave office. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
In World Cup soccer action, Saudi Arabia upset Belgium 1-0, and the Netherlands defeated Morocco 2-0. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2.5 points to close at 3,667. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. It's so hot in the Southwest that sitting on a sidewalk can lead to second-degree burns. That's what happened in Chandler, Arizona, when doctors treated a 15-month-old girl who fell on the pavement outside her home yesterday. Temperatures in the region are getting close to triple digits even before the sun comes up, and it's not dry heat either. Many parts of the normally arid region are dealing with humidity, too. Meteorologists say the dome of hot air that's stuck over the region isn't moving, and extremely high heat is forecast for several more days. A Colombian man suspected of flying several tons of cocaine into the United States and Canada for South American drug cartels has been arrested by United States authorities. Ansel Martinez reports.
Federal prosecutors nabbed Luis Carlos Herrera Lascano while he was on a business trip earlier this month to the Caribbean island of Aruba. Authorities allege he was negotiating landing rights on the island for his Colombian-based air cargo companies. They were apparently fronts for a huge drug transportation operation. Investigators say the 41-year-old man coordinated resupply of chemicals needed in the refinement of cocaine to South American drug labs. Planes would then fly stockpiles of the finished product to drop-off points further north, anywhere from Central America to Canada. Three other individuals associated with the network are wanted by American and Colombian police. The Department of Justice says the ring smuggling and money laundering activities began as early as 1982, and the cocaine handled was worth billions of dollars. For National Public Radio, I'm Ansel Martinez reporting.
An explosion yesterday at an Indianapolis feed mill could mean layoffs. A spokesman for Central Soya says some workers may have to be furloughed until the company repairs millions of dollars of damage. Investigators are still trying to determine what sparked the apparent blast. Residents up to 5 miles away felt the explosion. 11 people were hurt, 4 critically. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For many of us, airline travel has become an exercise in confusion. Ticket prices keep changing, and you may be shut out of the low fare that you're eligible for. Airlines have gone broke, others are threatening to, and in the meantime, the new no-frills airlines seem to be changing some of the rules of the game. Jim Glab is a journalist who covers the travel industry. He's the author of a new book about the airlines after deregulation called Rapid Descent. I asked him why there are so many different fares for each flight and why the price depends on how far ahead you book and whether you stay over Saturday night.
Well, this is something that developed out of deregulation. The airlines invented a new science called yield management or capacity management, and essentially it allows them to constantly juggle and rejuggle the mix of fares that are available on a given flight with the goal of selling the most seats at the highest possible fares. So if they see that a flight is booking up pretty well in advance of what they had expected, they can offer fewer discount seats on it and expect to sell the remaining seats at higher fares. If a flight is selling more slowly than they had anticipated, they can open up more seats with discount fares in an effort to fill up those seats.
It seems that people who really get clipped on the major airlines are business people who just find out Tuesday that they have to fly someplace on Thursday and they're not staying over Saturday night, and boy, do they have to pay high rates.
Well, that's certainly true, and that's just part of the whole commodity pricing structure that we've been talking about. The fact is that airline seats are perishable, and as the departure date approaches, if you need to travel and you still can't meet the requirements for the discount fares, you have to pay that higher fare. Their ultimate object is to, like I said before, get as much as they can for every seat on the plane.
Now, is this working for the airlines, the system?
Well, it has worked at times in the past, and at other times it has worked less successfully. I think right now the airlines are struggling with ways to adjust their pricing to compete effectively against a lot of these new low-fare airlines that have started up and are offering low fares on every seat with no purchase restrictions.
Why are we seeing this proliferation now of no-frill, cut-rate airlines?
Well, partly because the industry went through a period of significant consolidation during the mid to late 1980s, resulting in, you know, a few big airlines controlling the bulk of the market. And that created some opportunities for new competitors to come in and try to undercut them. Also, we have a situation in the industry where there are a lot of airplanes available at fairly low lease rates because there is so much surplus capacity in the industry. Some of the big airlines have been grounding their planes or turning them back to the leasing companies. We also have a surplus of experienced airline employees who lost their jobs when companies like Eastern and Pan Am went out of business. So given the opportunity for new competition and given the availability of relatively inexpensive aircraft and personnel, it's the perfect time for a new entrant to come into the industry.
So are the big airlines worried?
Oh, I think they're worried, sure, especially not so much by the smaller recently formed airlines like ValueJet and Kiwi. They're still too small to be much of a factor. I think the big airlines are more worried by people like Southwest Airlines, which has been expanding significantly in recent years, and last year was the only major airline to make a profit, and also by operations like the new Continental Light, the short-haul, low-fare service that Continental Airlines has been starting up and expanding in the eastern third of the United States.
So what moves do you see the older major airlines making to stay competitive with these newer ones?
Right now, airlines like United, Delta, and American are desperate to reduce their own operating costs so that they can compete effectively against these lower-cost airlines. United has taken the approach of turning over a large part of the company to the employees in exchange for substantial wage concessions. And if that is approved by shareholders, I think it's due for a vote next month, they plan to start up a low-fare short-haul division of United called U2, although it will have a new name eventually, operating much like Southwest or much like Continental Light, with fast turnaround service, low fares, and all 737 fleet, that kind of thing. Meanwhile, American and Delta are looking for ways. They have not taken that option of trying to start up a low-cost airline within an airline like United is, but they're looking for ways to come to terms with their employees for overall lower wage costs and higher productivity so that they can get their total operating costs down to the level of a Southwest or a Continental.
What is fast turnaround service?
Well, that simply means that when the plane comes into the gate, it will depart again in a relatively short period of time, maybe 30 to 45 minutes instead of 60 to 90 minutes as might have been traditional in earlier years.
And that saves money?
Well, that saves money because they can increase the productivity of that aircraft. They can have the plane in the air more hours of the day. And there's an old adage in the airline business that a plane doesn't make any money unless it's in the air.
What advice do you have for plane travelers this summer about how to shop for the best rates?
Well, I think probably the smartest thing to do would be to go to a good travel agent, because most travel agencies nowadays have very sophisticated computer systems that can search across all of the airlines to find the best fare that applies to the particular circumstances of that individual, you know, depending on what kind of restrictions they can put up with, when they want to travel, what airports they want to leave from and arrive in, that kind of thing. It's incredibly complicated, and trying to shop around by yourself, you know, calling individual airlines on the telephone can be a very frustrating experience.
My guest is Jim Glab. He's the co-author of a book about the airlines called Rapid Descent. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Glab, and he's co-author of a new book about the airline industry called Rapid Descent. I'm interested in the frequent flyer programs. You know, for those of us who are enrolled in one or more of these programs, we're all bracing ourselves for the number of miles that you need to get a free ticket to go up, and I think it's January, and at least two of the airlines going up from 20,000 to 25,000. It seems to me the airlines kind of figured out that a lot of people were eligible for free tickets, and they decided they needed to up the ante.
Yeah,
is that what happened?
What you're seeing with the frequent flyer programs is essentially inflation, just like you see in an economy, except the currency is miles instead of dollars. The fact is that the amount of miles in the bank, so to speak, has been increasing geometrically for several years now for a couple of reasons. And number one, more and more people are joining these programs. They're adding thousands of new members every month. And number two, the airlines have been creating a lot of new ways to earn miles other than actually flying on that airline itself. They have affinity credit cards now so that you can earn miles based on the dollars you spend on the credit card. They have tie-ins with other kinds of travel companies so that you can earn miles for staying in certain hotel chains. And they have tie-ins now with the major long-distance companies so you can earn miles based on your residential phone bills. So with all this activity, we're seeing a big increase in the number of unclaimed miles that are building up. And this is reflected as a liability on the airline's balance sheets. And they want to obviously try to limit that as much as they can. So they're just bringing the cost of a free ticket up to keep everything in balance.
What's in it for the airlines to have the frequent flyer programs?
Customer loyalty. They've found over the years that these programs have been extremely successful in building a loyal customer base. And it also gives them a very effective way to communicate with their best customers, because they do send out, you know, mailings to their program members from time to time, telling them about all kinds of developments within the airline and special bonuses and deals that are available to them.
So are the airlines making money on the frequent flyer programs?
Well, that's a good question. Some airlines insist that they are, that they do in fact bring in more revenue from incremental business and from payments from their partner companies than they cost to operate. Other analysts in the industry claim that they're a big loss factor for the airlines and they'd be better off without them. So the truth probably lies somewhere in between. Some analysts say that it's essentially a zero-sum game.
What do you think with the fares coming down at some airlines because of the competition from the new no-frills airlines? Do you think the frequent flyer programs will remain in place?
Oh, yeah. I don't think there are very many observers out there who think that the airlines are going to get rid of the frequent flyer programs anytime soon. There is a movement afoot in the corporate community. About 15 large corporations have formed an organization and hired a consultant to bargain with the airlines for new ways of pricing tickets for these companies and their business travelers. What they're looking for, essentially, is lower fares from the airlines for their travelers. And in exchange, they say the airlines should no longer give their employees frequent flyer miles, nor should the airlines pay commissions to their travel agencies. Now, whether that proposal is ever going to get off the ground really remains to be seen. It's subject to Justice Department review before it goes to the airlines. And then once it goes to the airlines, I think they'll be very... It's very questionable whether they might want to adopt that. Earlier this year, IBM approached some of the major airlines with a similar idea of foregoing frequent flyer miles for its employees in exchange for discount fares, and the airlines rejected that proposal.
There's a lot of places where I've had to get to in the past few years where I have to take connecting flights. And that's because of what's called the hub system. You go to one city, and then you take a flight to the smaller city. And is it true that there's more connecting flights now than there used to be?
Yeah, studies have shown that you do have a greater number of options to choose from if you're trying to get from point A to point B, although for the most part they do involve going through a hub. The hub-and-spoke systems evolved after deregulation or around the time of deregulation because the airlines saw that they offered a significant benefit in terms of passenger retention, that is, keeping the passenger on their airline for the entire duration of his flight. Before deregulation, we used to see a lot more what was called interlining, where passengers would take one airline to point A and transfer to another airline to go to point B. That has been significantly reduced by the creation of these hub-and-spoke systems, so you're much more likely now to stay on one airline for the full course of your journey than you were before.
I've had a couple of flights in the past year where I took a big jet to a hub city like Boston and then a little prop plane from, say, Boston to a smaller city in Maine. Some of these prop planes are strike me as being pretty old. And I'm wondering if their existence is because of the hub system or if they're being... I'm wondering, too, if they're being used past the age that they should be.
Well, they're being used to smaller cities out of the hubs for a matter of simple economics. I mean, there simply is not, there aren't enough passengers in some of these cities to justify putting a larger aircraft into those markets. So they use the smaller planes simply because they don't have many passengers and because that way they can offer more frequency of service in and out of the hub.
Mm-hmm.
As for the safety angle, I believe the federal government is currently looking into a lot of the safety regulations as far as commuter and regional airlines are affected with a view toward perhaps upgrading them so they're more on a par with the regulations that the major airlines have to abide by. And, of course, the question of aging aircraft is something that's always around. It's true, I don't know about the commuter aircraft, but I know among the major airlines it's true that the average age of aircraft has tended to increase over the last decade, although that's starting to turn around now because all of the airlines have to be equipped with what are known as Stage 3 aircraft, that is a quiet aircraft, by the end of this decade. So you're seeing a lot of new planes coming online now and in the next few years.
What are some of your frustrations as a flyer?
Well, one frustration I do have is, and this may be a personal peeve, but carry-on baggage is a frustration that I run into a lot, especially on full airplanes when... people try to board before the row number is called simply so that they can get their bags into that overhead bin before it fills up. And if you can't, and you can't fit it under the seat, then you have to check it, then you have to wait to get it when the plane gets there, and it's a big hassle. And it's going to be getting tougher in the future because some airlines I know of are going to be enforcing the carry-on baggage rules more strictly.
Why?
Well, simply so that they can implement these fast turnaround services. It seems that a major element in flight delays is carry-on baggage, the fact that people come on board at the last minute with a bag that won't fit anywhere because everything is full, and the flight attendants have to try to encourage him to check it, and he'll want to check every overhead bin before he'll do that, and that can delay the flight departure.
Do you usually worry about safety when you fly, or are you confident?
No, I don't worry about safety at all. Mm-hmm. The statistics just aren't there to create any significant element of risk as far as I'm concerned.
Have you flown on the no-frill airlines yet?
Yeah, I flew on Kiwi International not too long ago.
What's different about it?
Well, for one thing, the walk-up fare, the fare that you get on the same day of departure, was pretty low. Major airlines that compete against it will tend to match those fares, but only on their flights that depart at about the same time as Kiwi flights depart. The aircraft itself was a little worn around the edges, maybe, but the service was fine, and the attitude of the employees was really quite refreshing, I think probably because they all own part of the airline. I think that can make a big difference in the quality of service that you get from airline employees.
The employees are shareholders?
Yes, and we've seen instances in the past, in the 1980s, when there was a lot of labor turmoil in the industry, that having an unhappy workforce at an airline can cost you a lot of business, because one surly remark from an airline employee can send a passenger away from that airline for the rest of his life.
So many more people seem to be flying nowadays. Why are so many of the major airlines having so much trouble making a profit and even staying in business?
Well, the major airlines, after this round of consolidation that I mentioned, were in fact making pretty good profits in the late 1980s. The problems came in 1990-91 when they got hit by a real double whammy. Number one was the recession, which was beginning about then. Number two was the Gulf War. The Gulf War scared a lot of people out of the skies, not only on international flights, but even on domestic. Airline traffic took a real nosedive around that time. And then with the recession kicking in and businesses cutting down on their business travel, the major airlines found that they had a lot more planes in the air than they could justify based on the number of people that were traveling. So it was basically a simple supply and demand equation that was turning against the airlines in the early 90s.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jim Glab is the author of Rapid Descent. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, there is a new prime minister in Japan. We'll have a piece analyzing how that happened and what it might mean. Also, a surge of refugees coming out of Haiti may force the hand of the Clinton administration. We'll have some commentary and some thoughts on that. The World Cup is moving into round two of competition, so we'll call in our soccer expert to tell us what he thinks is going to happen. Melissa Block is going to see the Holland Tunnel declared a national landmark, and Ira Glass has gone to a high school called Latino Youth High School. It's a magnet school in Chicago that serves Latino young people.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on the Fox Network, executive producer Aaron Spelling premieres a new series called Models Incorporated. It's a spinoff from Spelling's successful Melrose Place, which was a spinoff from his hit Beverly Hills 90210. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of Models Incorporated. Well, sort of.
Here's the way Aaron Spelling works. He establishes one successful foothold in TV, then uses that opportunity and that audience to build another and another and another. Most other TV producers try to work that way, too, but Aaron Spelling does it better than most, even though his programs aren't any better. He's the guy who gave us such TV lowlights as Starsky and Hutch, Charlie's Angels, The Love Boat, Fantasy Island, Dynasty, T.J. Hooker, and Hotel. In the 90s, he was down and almost out when he cut his longtime association with ABC and developed Beverly Hills 90210 for Fox. Now, once again, he's king of the trash TV hill. Beverly Hills begat Melrose Place, and back in April, Melrose Place began to beget Models Incorporated. Spelling settled on Linda Gray as the star of Models, a primetime soap about a woman running an agency for fashion models. Then Spelling showcased her as a special guest star on Melrose. Those appearances were hyped during the closing credits of Beverly Hills 90210, which, in the world of Aaron Spelling, is the perfect type of promotional synergy.
Now, if you thought Heather Locklear was the baddest girl at Melrose Place, wait till you meet her mother. Dallas's Linda Gray guest stars on an all-new Melrose Place next.
With this type of buildup, Spelling doesn't need to suffer the slings and arrows of outraged critics. So Models Incorporated comes to TV tonight without any advance copies being sent to reviewers. Not that I'm complaining. After all, anyone who watches Melrose knows what to expect anyway, because elements setting up Models Incorporated were incorporated into last season's final Melrose shows. There was the photo shoot with beautiful women on the beach and popular music on the soundtrack.
Maya?
And there was the continued bad blood between Heather Locklear's Amanda and her mother, played by Linda Gray. Here's their initial confrontation from that April edition of Melrose Place.
You know, I left 20 years ago. I can't make up for it, but I wish that we could leave it in the past.
Some things you do are permanent, Mother. They don't go away no matter how hard you try.
Look, Mandy.
Don't do this.
I still remember that day. You were at school, and I walked into your room. All those fashion dolls and the posters.
Oh, please. It's all very calculated and corny and overblown. But here's the embarrassing part. It was that same episode, which also had a character coming back from the dead, that actually got me hooked on the all-out silliness of Melrose Place. It's definitely a guilty pleasure, with more guilt than pleasure. Then again, I remember watching Charlie's Angels, too, although with the volume turned off. Come to think of it, that may be the best advice regarding Models Incorporated. Go ahead and watch it if you want. Just don't listen to it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Hunting Comets, we talk with amateur astronomer David Levy. He spent hundreds of hours watching the sky and has discovered 19 comets, including the comet that's destined to crash into Jupiter next month. In fact, the comet is named after him. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.